Hey everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Jennifer and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hey y'all, welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Oh, let me read that again. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in the room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So I could just introduce Rusty. And I was this line from a Keith Urban song just keeps going through my head that said, people love me because I'm part of you. And I initially got to meet Rusty because he fell in love with my best friend and she him. And I am so grateful for that. I have gotten to know him through the way he loves her and what's happened through her and how she's just sort of lit up as they've been together. I love this man very, very much, and I'm so grateful he's in my life. And so we get to hear Rusty tell his story.
My name is Rusty Levy. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jennifer. I love you, too. My sobriety date is St. Patrick's Day, 1999. That's kind of important because I'm from Savannah. And I did not drink on St. Patrick's Day, 1999. I have a home group. It is the Chapter 3 group. We meet at the North Springs United Methodist Church in Sandy Springs on Thursdays at 7 o'clock. You're more than welcome to join us. We have a literature-based open discussion meeting. I have a sponsor, and I am a sponsor. And I participate in the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of that kind of put together is the reason I'm standing here today. I was born into an average, you know, white middle class family. My father was a college professor. My mom was a homemaker for a little while we were young, and then she got into being a secretary, went to school and got her own degree and started teaching as well. My grandparents are fairly educated folks, did fairly well. Both my grandfathers were in the military during World War II, came back, and my one grandfather went into the Corps of Engineers. The other grandfather went to work at Union Camp Paper Corporation in Savannah. He would go out into the field and it's not called running timber, but he would go and we're going to buy all this, and then they'd ship it all to the plant in Savannah. So my grandmother on my mother's side was a teacher at Savannah High School for a good number of years and then Windsor Forest, and she was a well-educated woman, very smart woman, and a very religious woman. And my other grandmother was a homemaker and a model when she was young, but when she and my dad's dad got married, she became mostly a homemaker and took care of the boys and said, your father is going to deal with you when you get home, a lot. So I understand. So my sister and I were, like I said, born into a pretty average middle-class family. We had more than we probably should have had growing up. My dad really wanted us to enjoy being kids. We had, you know, vans and boats and a nice home. Wasn't the biggest home or the biggest boat or the biggest van or anything like that, but we lived well above our means. There's no alcoholism in my family that I know of. My dad had a half-brother. My grandmother had a son from a first marriage. And he died of this disease and its complications. But in a direct line, we don't know of anyone going back from me that is an alcoholic. My mom is an only child, and that plays a whole lot into the relationship that my parents had. Now, you know, when I'm young, I'm just happy that Meemaw will give me presents and do stuff for me and take me where I want to go and all that good stuff. And I was kind of the golden child of the family, really on both sides. I was the oldest true grandson on both sides. My Uncle Myron, who's the half-brother, had kids, but they weren't my grandfather's. They were my grandmother's. But he adopted Myron into the family, and then he had kids. And my grandfather, you know, saw them as his own, more or less. But there was always something just a little different, I think. But I was the first true Lavely grandson, grandchild on either side. And so I got spoiled a bit. A bit is probably an understatement, to say the least. And as I grew up, we moved around a little bit when I was young. I was born in Athens. My sister was born in Florida, and we moved to Texas. My dad got his PhD there. We moved to Richmond. My dad got his first job there. We stayed there for a year. And then we moved to a little town called Martin, Tennessee, which is way up in the northwest corner. My dad got a teaching job at the University of Tennessee at Martin, which is a branch campus of Knoxville. And he taught there for 28 and a half years and retired from there several years ago now and started his own business. But I grew up in a little town, Martin, about 6,000 people. When the university was in session, it was 12,000 people. So, you know, the town doubled. And it was a small town, and it acted like a small town, and that's just the way it was. We moved into my house on my 7th birthday, and so really most of my childhood memories are from times in Martin. And I was always part of one group and wanted to be part of another. Now, it could be any group that I wanted to be part of at a particular time, and this is, a lot of this is in retrospect. I never really figured out what issues I had or problems I had. I always felt like everything was fine. But I always, you know, in looking back, I always wanted to be part of the next group of whatever it was. And so, you know, I wanted to be in, I didn't go to the right kindergarten, because I didn't go to kindergarten in Martin. And so I didn't go to the right kindergarten, so I didn't get into that clique, Miss Mary's, I think it was. I didn't go to Miss Mary's kindergarten, so I was never in that clique. And that was all the, you know, well-off, well-to-do, doctors, lawyers, kids, and all that stuff. So I was already out of that clique. And so I went through this period where I was with the neighborhood kids, and then things started changing. People started getting and going in different directions. I like different music than they like, so I went over here. They went over there, and I developed this new. And I was a bit of a nerd. I got pretty smart parents and grandparents, and so I'm an intellectual. I'm just telling you that right now. I'm a smart guy. And as you hear my story, you'll see how smart I am by what I did. But I was a reasonably smart kid. I excelled in school. I was part of the CLU program, which is the smart kids program. I don't know why they really got me in there, but and I used that to what I thought was my advantage. Really, it was a disadvantage in some ways, because I got picked on and beat on and all that by the rough kids. So I tried to avoid them as much as I could. But when I got into I got into the band for a little while, and then I didn't like that, so I got out of that. After I bought this, my parents bought this $1,000 French horn, I decided I don't want to play it anymore. So it's like, you know, and when your dad's making $30,000 a year, that's an expensive instrument. When I was 14, I started hanging out with some other kids who like to do naughty things like we do, drink and do some other stuff. And alcohol for me during my late junior high and high school years was kind of a sideshow. It was the other things that I liked to do, and that progressed a little bit over time. But I remember sitting in Craig, this guy named Craig, I remember sitting in his living room imbibing on my first green leafy alcohol, and I remember feeling like I was okay for the first time. Now, the problem with that story is I never felt like I wasn't okay before then. But once I got that sensation, I knew that the normal me was, something was wrong with that. Something wasn't right. Now, again, this is really in retrospect that I'm understanding this. But something was different. And I was perfectly okay then and there with who I was, what I was. It did, none of that matter. None of the other stuff mattered. I was just happy. I was content. I was happy. Everything was good. And I do remember after that seeking that feeling for the next 17 years. And I often found it over the next 10 or 12 years. I had a lot of fun drinking and doing the other stuff I did. I developed a group of friends, and we all did the same thing, and we had a good time, and, you know, we got through school, and everything was great, and we all graduated, you know, high up in our classes. We didn't get in any trouble. Of course, our parents knew the police chief and the fire chief and the mayor and all that, so it wasn't like we were going to get into much trouble. It wasn't as bad as it is today. If you got caught, they just called your parents, and your parents dealt with you, but it wasn't like it was a big crime issue like it is in a lot of places today. Martin today is a methamphetamine infested town. We didn't know anything about that back then. So we had a good time. We had fun. I had a good time growing up. Now, you know, I went through high school, did well. Went through college, did well. Got into medical school, and all of a sudden things got hard. I don't know if y'all know this, but medical school is not easy. I thought it was going to be easy. I beforehand, I never had to do much to make good grades in school and had a good GPA and all that. Of course, at the same time that my intellectualness was taking a nosedive, my use of alcohol and other things was increasing precipitously. Now, I didn't put that two and two together. I just assumed that, you know, there's something going on here. But the first 2 years of med school were a challenge for me. I started off well, and it went downhill from there. And I had progressed from drinking occasionally and doing these other things occasionally to drinking most days and doing these other things most days, and including some other more advanced things most days. I got to a point where I failed my boards a couple times, and I was about to be kicked out of medical school. Well, I can't have that. I'm an intellectual. I'm supposed to, this is supposed to be easy. I'm supposed to get this done. So I buckled down, and I did what an intellectual would do. I bought myself a review course in Kansas City, Missouri. I went out there for 6 weeks, and I studied real hard, and I passed my boards, and I came back, and I started with the class behind me. Now, at the time, that didn't seem like a big deal. I didn't really care about it. In looking back at it, that's kind of an ego basher when you're not with your class that you've been with for 2 years. It kind of beats on your ego a little bit. But I had a few friends in that class, and so I was able. And I still had my friends who, some of them had moved down from Martin and were now living and working in Memphis or going to school in Memphis, grad school, whatever. So we still had the little clique was still together. And we were still doing all the things we did, albeit more than we did them. We just advanced it over time. We were getting older. We could handle more, so we just do a little more. And so we did a little more, and we did a little more often, and we did whatever. And we were still having a big time. We weren't getting in any real trouble, but things were starting to be obviously not as good as they used to be. So I got into my fourth year of medical school. And you have to take a second set of boards. So the first set tests your first 2 years of basic science stuff. The second one tests your clinical knowledge. So I said, I'm an intellectual. I know how to pass this test, and it's to go do a board review course. So I plunked down some money, and I went to Kansas City. Now, mind you, all this is student loans. I'm just taking out more loans to go do all this stuff, racking up a nice big bill. Went out to Kansas City. This was a 3-week deal, not a 6-week. You didn't need quite as much. Well, 2 days before the board test, I needed some brakes on my car, so I went to this little gas station, and I left it with them to put some brakes on the car. Across the street, I don't know if you've been to Kansas City. Kansas City has nice big roads. They have wide open spaces and nice big roads and parkways and all. Well, this was a nice, you know, 6-lane road or whatever. I went across the street. There was a bar. And, you know, this bar had the trivia game. Well, I like trivia. So I decided to go have a drink and play some trivia. Well, this was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, at 8 o'clock, they came over to get me to tell me that my car was ready, had been ready for quite some time. So I walked back across. I paid for my car. Now, mind you, the board test is not the next day, but the next. It's 2 days away. Right? What would any normal person do? They'd get in their car, go home, and study a little bit or whatever. Well, what did I do? I left my car there, walked back across the street to the bar. Well, at 2 o'clock when the bar closed, they told me I had to leave. And so I was probably 5-6 miles from where I was staying, and I got in my car, and I drove. And I don't remember any of this now, but I drove. And when I got on one of these really nice wide-open parkways, I decided I was going to figure out how fast my car would go at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was in Lenexa, Kansas. And I've never been to Lenexa, Kansas. Well, I'll just cut the story short. I know what the jail in Lenexa, Kansas looks like. Because when the police officer pulled me over, the first words out of his mouth, and I do remember this, is, "I don't know how fast you were going, but my radar gun peaks at 115. And then he told me that my seatbelt wasn't fastened and some light was not working, and so I got these three other little charges. But anyway, what sucks about that is the apartment was right there. I was at the exit going to my apartment, and he pulled me over. I'm like, "You gotta be kidding me." Well, anyway, so that night, I get to spend the night in the Lenexa jail. I call my friend who I'm staying with the next morning. "Can you come get me out? Come get me out." You know, I'm hungover, but I never was one of those people that just couldn't function with a hangover. I can feel it, but it's not driving me nuts. I got a little headache or whatever. I take some Advil or what have you, and it goes away. And I go to take the test the next day. They took my driver's license, but that was back in the days when no one talked to each other. So I just drove my car, and I went, took the test, drove back to Tennessee, called my parents' friend at the county commission, at the county office, and said, "I lost my driver's license," and they sent me a new one. So I had a new one within a week or so. And I found out I passed the test, so I got to graduate from medical school. And another one of the consequences that I had as a result of my alcoholism and the other things that I did was I didn't do very well in medical school. I mean, I did much better in the clinical years than the basic science years, but they look at your whole picture when they're thinking about residencies, and I didn't get into the residency that I wanted. But I did get into a one-year internship in Savannah at Memorial Hospital so that I could have another year and learn that and then try the next year to get into a residency. And so I went to Savannah, or I was going to Savannah. Well, I had this sneaking suspicion that they were going to drug test me. And so I decided in my intellectualism that I would stop doing everything but alcohol on April the 1st. Now, just so you know, April Fool's Day is not a good day to try to stop doing anything. You should pick a different day. April 2nd probably wouldn't have been a better day. I might would have succeeded if I had picked April the 2nd, but I didn't. I picked April the 1st. And I didn't stop on April the 1st, and I didn't stop on May the 1st, and I didn't stop on June the 1st. 3 days before I left for Savannah, I quit all that other stuff but alcohol. And I drove to Savannah, and guess what? They drug tested me. Can you imagine that? Why would they do that? I knew they were going to do it, and I couldn't stop. And so they wanted to let me go immediately. However, my family is well integrated into the medical system in Savannah, and I had a lot of friends, even board members on that hospital, who pulled a few strings. And so I got to sign a contract that said if we're going to test you periodically, and if you ever have a positive test, you're out of here. And I was signed that, and I agreed to it. Well, alcohol did for me what the other stuff did, sometimes in varying speeds, but it worked. And so I became a fish. I mean, I was, every time I was away from the hospital, I was drinking. And I had my favorite watering hole. It's called Gallagher's. And I'd walk in at 4:30 in the afternoon. I'd finish all my hospital stuff, and I was like Norm. My drink was waiting on me. It was a styrofoam cup about that big with about that much wild turkey in it, a little bit of Coke and some ice. I loved the kicking chicken. That was my drink. I mean, it was good with just enough Coke to give it a little, to take the bite off. But and I would have 6-8 of those a night, and then I'd go home and sleep it off and go to work the next day. So that September, I was taking a trip to Europe, meeting my friends over there. I was poor, so we didn't do much. I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money as a resident, so we weren't doing the high life on the trip. But we were going to Amsterdam. Anybody know anything about Amsterdam? Okay, they like to party in Amsterdam. And I had had several drug screens up until that point. most people would say, you know what, I had this issue, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to participate in what they do in Amsterdam. And I decided that, oh, I'll be all right. So I participated in what they did in Amsterdam. And I got back, and they didn't test me. They didn't test me for another year and 4 months. By that time, I progressed all the way through all the stuff I said I would never do. The only thing I did not do was stick a needle in my arm. But pretty much everything else I did. And I'm drinking the whole time. So alcohol is always there. Alcohol is kind of the before, middle, and after, and then all the other stuff's whipped up around it. I'm just seeking glory wherever I can find it. And I found a lot of it for a while. So I got into the residency that I wanted to get into, which was radiation oncology. And in February of 1996, I get a DUI in Savannah. Well, guess where they take me? To my hospital. Take me into the emergency room in my hospital. The nurses all see me come in, and I party with the nurses. And I'll tell you, nurses will party and have a good time. And they take me into the private room in the back immediately. And I'm talking to them. I'm talking to Robin. I'm Robin, do something. Get this out of my system. You know, I intellectually, I know that it's not going to happen. But I'm like, just put some saline in there and take a little bit of blood and send it off and see if the count will be low. And I'm like, oh, it doesn't happen. I'm handcuffed to the gurney. And people are stopping by and looking in the room. All right. Well, somehow or another, my program director never found out about that, or if he did, he never said anything about it. I still to this day have no idea how that happened, but at any rate, so that was late June of 1996. So in February of 1998, I figured out they're not testing me, so I must be good. So I'm doing all the other stuff I used to do, plus all the drinking that I like to do. And I get called to go do a drug screen. This isn't my program director. This is just, I'm the random guy that day in the whole hospital system that gets chosen. Well, I know that I'm going to fail this thing because I've done, you know, 9 things to Sunday in the last 24 hours. I got one of the medical students that was working on my team to pee in a Ziploc bag. I took it with me. Well, unfortunately for me, they do observed. I mean, they don't look right at you, but they're in the room with you. So it's a little hard to get a Ziploc bag out and put it in the cup. And so I knew I was fried. And guess what? I was fried. They politely asked me to resign. They didn't want any deal with the state. They didn't want to deal with the board. They asked me to resign. I resigned. They gave me, you know, 6 months of pay to go away, basically. 6 weeks of pay to go away. So I went away. And I managed to get clean for about 6 or 8 weeks because I needed a job. I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have anything to do. You know, my family during all this time has no idea what's going on. I basically just told them that I didn't enjoy what I was doing and I left and I'm going to reevaluate my situation and all that blah, blah, blah. You know, the stuff that we say. They still think I'm all right and I'm doing fine. My grandmother still thinks I'm on the moon and that everything's wonderful and life's going to be great. One of the things I had to do, though, was I had to call the residency I'd gotten into and tell them what I had done. And they politely asked me not to come. So I was out of the residency that I really wanted to get into. Excuse me. So I managed to get clean for 6-8 weeks. I got a job at the county health department. I passed the drug screen. I passed all of whatever I needed to do. And I was there for a little while. And then I got a job at a dock-in-a-box shop. Well, I was only working 2 days a week, making pretty good money for 2 days a week, and I didn't have anybody looking over my shoulder then. And I just went right back to where I was. I was drinking like a fish. I was doing all the other stuff I was doing. I advanced to some very, 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 very rough stuff that kicked my butt. And by the time October of 1998 rolled around, they confronted me and said, "You got to, you know, I don't know what the hell's going on, but you're something's wrong here. This is the problem." And I, you know, they guessed, and they sent me to treatment. Well, after a week of treatment, well, I went to Charter by the Sea. Anybody ever heard of Charter by the Sea? It's a wonderful place in St. Simons. It's beautiful. It's right by the sea. Not really. You can't see the sea from Charter by the Sea. It's in the middle of the island. But they took you to the sea, or at least they did a couple times. And I walked in, and this was my first experience with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. I saw them on the wall. And I did exactly what every one of you did, and if you say you didn't do it, you're a liar. I said, I can do that one, but I don't need that one or that one or that one. And I got to 12, and I'm happy to help you with your problems, right? That's what we all do. We all do the ones we can do, and then we check off all the 10 or 11 that we're not going to do. Because we all have one that we're capable of doing, right? At least one, maybe two, but, you know, the rest of them don't apply. After 7 days, I convinced my job that I was cured, and I left treatment and came right back to work. Well, before I even got back to Savannah from Brunswick, I had already called my people, and so I was starting right back up. Well, by the end of February 1999, the job had had enough. They sent me a nice FedEx letter of, don't show up anymore. We don't want you. We don't need you. By that point, I hadn't paid rent. I'd been living with my grandmother before, but she asked me, you know, after the October thing, she said, you can't live here anymore. I had broken her heart, you know, and she started going to Al-Anon, and God Almighty, Lord have mercy. It was all bad at that point. So by that point, the family knew something was wrong, and then they figured out what the problem was. What's wrong with Rusty? Now we know what's wrong with Rusty. So over the next 4 months, I spent six figures on all my stuff. I lost about 40, 50 pounds. I hadn't paid rent in 3 or 4 months, hadn't paid utilities in 3 or 4 months, hadn't paid the car payment in 3 or 4 months. I was a miserable son of a bitch. I really was. I was in bad shape. And I will tell you this, for the last 2 or 3 years that I went through this, I thought I was just going to stop one day. I just wasn't ready. I had some bad breaks, some things didn't go my way. One of these days I'm going to stop. And I really thought it was going to pick up exactly where it left off, where I wanted it to be. So that was February 28th. On Wednesday, 14, 13, 12, 11, on Wednesday, March the 10th, my sister calls me out of the blue and says, we put $1,000 down on a treatment center here in Tennessee. We'll come get you if you want to go to treatment. And the book talks about a moment of clarity. Well, that was mine. I had it right then and there. I said, you know what? I better take this because I don't know if I have another one. Now, it wasn't as clear as that in my head at that point, but I knew I needed to do something different than what I was doing. And so I said, okay. So they came down on Friday. We moved my stuff out of my apartment over to my grandmother's storage area on Saturday and Sunday. Now, mind you, I haven't quit doing anything yet. What I would do is I'd help them load up a car and send them over. And then I would stay in the apartment. I'm going to pack up some more stuff. And I would do some more stuff. On Sunday at about, I don't know, mid-afternoon, I sent them with the last load of stuff. I said, I got a few more things. I'll pack them up and I'll be right behind you. Well, I had borrowed some money from this person or that person. I had several hundred dollars in my pocket, and I promptly spent most of it over the next few hours. I had $150 left at about 9:30. I had half of a joint in my little box, because, you know, we all have a little box where we keep our stuff. Some people have a crown roll bag. You know, I had a crown roll bag at one time. It just wasn't big enough for all my stuff. So I had a box. I smoked that just to calm myself down. I had I had a little bit of wild turkey left, and I drank that to calm myself down from the other stuff that I was doing. And I went to see two people that I had borrowed $50 from. And I told them where I was going. I gave them the $50. They both wished me well. And then I showed up at my grandmother's house at 11:30. Well, every light is on in the house. Now, my grandmother goes to bed at 9:30. She doesn't stay up till 11:30. She's sitting in her chair. My sister and her husband are sitting on the sofa. I walk in the door. All three rise like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Where have you been? What's been going on? And I just walked in and I said, I'm ready. Now, the book talks about the mental obsession. And being relieved of the mental obsession is something that God has to do for us, because we cannot do that for ourselves. There is no doubt in my mind that that's when I was relieved of the mental obsession, to drink. Because never since that time, on that date, Sunday, March the 14th, at 11:30 p.m., in 1999, have I wanted to drink or use drugs. Thoughts have crossed my mind about it, but that urge, that need to have a drink has never come into my mind. It just hasn't. Now, I didn't know what that was at the time. It probably was 10 or 12 years later before I looked back on that, once I got a better understanding of what the mental obsession really was, once I understood what the physical craving was. But I think that's when that happened. And I think God decided, he's too damn intellectual. I can't let him go for very long. I know some people talk about that going on for weeks and months. I'm grateful that I did not have that happen to me, because I'm not sure I would have survived it. But I know people talk about it, and I understand it. So we left on Monday morning for Tennessee, a little town called Hohenwald. Everybody called it Hole in the Wall, to a little treatment center, 21-day program called Buffalo Valley. Well, I got to Buffalo Valley, and on the very first day I was there, my counselor gave me a pamphlet called King Baby. an intellectual narcissist I am, okay? And I know it, and it is what it is. I was there for 21 days. I completed their program. They recommended that I go to long-term treatment. I went to long-term treatment at Palmetto Addiction Recovery, which is in a cow pasture in Rayville, Louisiana. I was there for 4 months for a 90-day program. I completed my first 5 steps there. I did my 5th step with an outside sponsor, quote-unquote, someone that was willing to do that. And then I wanted to go to Oregon. Now, I didn't know anyone in Oregon. I'd never been to Oregon. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a car. I didn't have anything to get me to Oregon, but I wanted to go to Oregon. Fortunately, they were smart people that worked at this treatment center, and they suggested that I probably not want to go to Oregon, that I probably ought to go back to Georgia, because I had surrendered my medical license at this point, and I needed to go back and deal with the board and get it back and go through all that process. So I transferred back here to MAR. Metro Atlanta Recovery Residence, as some of you probably are familiar with more. I didn't do their inpatient, but I went right into halfway. I was in halfway for 2.5 months. I was in three-quarter living for 8 months, and I was in independent living for a year. So I was in treatment for a total of 2.25 years. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Some of us take longer than others, I guess. The reality was I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't know that at the time, but I didn't have anywhere to go. I had trouble getting a job. I had trouble getting a minimum wage job. No one wanted to hire a physician to come in and do a I guess they were afraid I would, you know, try to tell them how to run the business, which I probably would have. But I had a friend in the program that I made after I got here, and his family owned a printing business, and so I got to work in the warehouse in the printing business for $8 an hour, which I actually enjoyed it. It was not a lot of intellectualness to it, but it was nice. You know, they wanted me to organize things, so I could go organize things. And my wife will tell you, I'm a little obsessive compulsive about organizing things. Right, hon? So I got to organize things and what have you. And then they put me in charge of this school book program the next summer. I was actually worked there for almost 2 years. And I was walking down the hall of MAR one day, and Doug Brush, the CEO, passed me, and then he turned around and he said, "Why are you still here?" And I said, "Well, no one told me to leave." And it instantly hit me that I had finally gotten comfortable just being there. Because I fought being everywhere during those first 2 years. But I hadn't thought about it for 3 or 4 months. I was just there. I was just doing whatever they told me to do. And so I was finally okay. I'd gotten my license back by this time, because I only had a year suspension, and I had some probation time, 5 years of probation that I had to do. And he said, "You know what? You need to leave. You need to start looking for a job back in the medical." So over the next several years, I worked at Duke University. That was my first job out of treatment. I then went to Vanderbilt University for my second job out of treatment. And then I got into a residency at Johns Hopkins. Now, what's funny about that is, you remember when I was not an alcoholic, I couldn't get into any residency anywhere. No one would have me. But once I became an alcoholic, I worked at Duke, at Vanderbilt, and Johns Hopkins. And I got the place, I got the position at Johns Hopkins from a referral from someone at Washington University in St. Louis, because they filled their position with someone else and they recommended me to the program director at Johns Hopkins. So I'm like, how does that happen? I mean, I was doing research at Duke and I was doing research at Vanderbilt. Somehow or another, that worked itself out. And so I got into nuclear medicine, which is what I do today. And I really enjoy what I do. I like my job a lot. It's in the radiology field. It's in the imaging field. Every one of these places, I had things to do for the board. I had to do urine tests, and I had to participate in 12-step recovery, and I had to check in with a psychiatrist or some caduceus, something like that. And I just did it. I just did what they told me to do because I wanted what they had to offer me. Well, at the same time, I was participating in a different 12-step recovery that uses the AA Big Book as its recovery program, fortunately for me. But when I got to Baltimore, this 12-step program wasn't there. So I got involved in AA once I got to Baltimore, and I've been in AA ever since. And it was an easy transition because to me, I'm an alcoholic. And when I come to AA, I say I'm an alcoholic, even though I know in my head I've got a lot of other things going on there. But I'm an alcoholic. It's easy for me to see. Alcohol was involved in everything that I did before I got here. And alcoholism is involved in most of the things now that I'm here because it's part of who I am. Well, I finished up my residency. The state of Georgia let me off probation 3 months early, which is unheard of. The state doesn't do anything early. They do most things late. They don't do anything early. But they let me off 3 months early, and I don't know why that was. Jim McNatt was the medical director, and they let me off early. But I stayed with, and that was, I was still had one more year at Hopkins. I just continued to do what they recommended. And that was because the psychiatrist there said, you know what, that way you'll have a clean slate with no gaps when you go to apply for that job. And I did. And I got a job in Savannah with a radiology group down there. Now, I'm going back to my old playgrounds, but it's also my home. I mean, this is where my family is from. I never really thought of Northwest Tennessee as my home. But I love Savannah, and I was eager to go back there to see friends, family, and what have you. So I got involved there, and I got hired by the group, and I started to do some of the work that I did and build up the program down there. Had some issues there, got involved with what's the name of our group? The Savannah Group. Oh, yeah. The Savannah Group. And I met Patty there. And Patty was heavily involved in service. She's got quite a few years on me. She had started this process a little sooner than I did in life. But we started going out and getting involved. We were really involved. And so we moved there about the same time. She came from Albany and I came from Baltimore. What time am I supposed to finish up? Okay. And so we started dating. We got engaged. So we started dating in July. We got engaged in February. We got married in June. Typical AA wedding, right? Let's get it done fast. We'll get it done. And I started to get interested in service work. I'd never been in service work up until this time. I mean, I had residency, I had all this other stuff going on, and the groups I was, well, that's not true. When I was in the other 12-step group, I actually became a state delegate for Tennessee when I was in Nashville. But I became a state delegate, and 2 months later I got the position at Hopkins, so I never actually got to fulfill the role that I was elected to do. But once I got into AA, I didn't do any service work because the group I was involved with in Baltimore, it wasn't a priority for them. But when I got to Savannah, I learned what service work was. We had people in the group that were heavily involved in service work, and they got me involved in service work, and I went through several different positions. I've been GSR at five different groups. Now, that's not because I finished two-year terms. It's because we kept moving. I left the group in Savannah and started working in Fayette County, so I couldn't be the GSR there because I wasn't there during the week. I was up here during the week, and we lived in Savannah. And then I became the GSR to group up here, and then Patty moved up, and she didn't like that group, so we went to another group. So I got involved in the service work of that group, and then you know, we moved. The company I was working for in Fayette County sold out to Northside Hospital, and so we moved up to Sandy Springs, and I was going to one group, and Patty was going to a different one, and I became GSR of that group. And we both kind of decided we didn't like the groups we were with, so we got together with some other people and started the Chapter 3 group. And then at some point, I became GSR of that group. I've been GSR at five different groups. Two or three years ago now, I became treasurer for the state, following in my wife's footsteps of service work at the area level. I'm currently alternate DCM for District 13A, Zone 13A. Service work is very important to me, and it doesn't matter what level it's at. It's just being of service. It's giving back to the organization so that it's here for the next person, the next Rusty who walks through the door and needs that hand to be there. I haven't talked much about my family during all this. My grandmother, who, again, I was like the golden child, and I really had a problem with her religion. She was a very religious person, very a Southern Baptist, very religious, knew the Bible backwards and forwards. She told the preacher when he said something wrong. And she was a teacher, so she tried to do it in an educational way, not a put-down way, but it didn't always come out that way, I'm sure. But I came to understand over time that she was also a very spiritual woman. She was very close to God as she understood God. Now, the God she believed in was the God of the Bible. She did not waver from that, and that's fine. It's perfectly fine. And that's not the God of my understanding exactly today. There are parts of that that I agree with, but there are some other things that I waver from. But I began to understand that, and I remember my grandmother had to move out of her house into assisted living because she just couldn't take care of everything anymore, and so we moved her into assisted living. I remember we were married, we were living in Savannah, she was in the assisted living. I was over at her apartment one day, and she was sitting in her chair, and I was sitting on the sofa next to her, and she reached over and patted me on the cheek, and she said, "It's your turn now." My grandmother was developing dementia, and I think she knew it. I think she had figured, we all knew it. I think she knew it. I think she knew it was happening. And I think what she was saying was, all the time that I had been there for you, it's now time for you to be here for me. Well, she died shortly thereafter. She had some medical complications from a surgery and died shortly thereafter. But and I cried like a baby. Oh, my God, it was awful. I think they heard me through the whole ICU. It was that bad. What was worse is my mother was the one that made me have to make the decision about when it was time to turn the machines off. So, you know, 5 days or 7 days later, when everybody had had a chance to come, the family, the friends, everybody had gotten to come, and we made the decision and let it go. But I understood. And it was through that process that I understood that she was a spiritual woman as well as a religious woman. Now, I'm not a religious person at all, but I have very minimal spirituality. If I place on God what my brain wants to, it'll be this intellectual ball of crap. And I just refuse to do that. So I keep God as simple as I possibly can, so that I don't complicate it, because I will screw it up if I do. And because I know that if I do that I will lose what I have. So I simply today try to be of service when I can, and it's not just in AA, but in my work. Even I know I'm getting paid for that, but I still try to be of service to the patients I have, to the doctors that I do, you know, the studies for. I try to be of service in AA. I try to be of service in my home. I'm not great at any of it. I try to be pretty good at most of it some of the time. I mean, I'm selfish in a lot of ways still. I like to sit in my room and smoke a cigar sometime when I should be doing something else. At least I've got an indoor room now, which I'm happy about. I have a group of friends and a group of associates that I enjoy spending time with and doing things with. Our life is pretty damn good, and I have God to thank for every bit of it. And the way I got to God was through Alcoholics Anonymous, because I didn't find God in the Southern Baptist Church. He's probably there. He's probably there for a lot of people, but I didn't find him there. And I didn't find him in the treatment center. He might be there for some people, but I didn't find him there. You know, I didn't find him in all the stuff that I did, but I found him in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I find him mostly when I listen to what people say, in the words that people use, and in the actions that I see. And I am forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for giving that to me, for giving me the life I have today. Because the path that I was on, if I was alive today, I'd be in awful, awful shape. I'm not sure that I would be alive today, but if I was, it would be bad. Because it was bad then, and it wasn't as bad as it could get. I owe everything I have, everything I am, everything I do to God as I understand God through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for that, and I hope that I forever will be. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Rusty. That was awesome. What's happening?
I'm going to try to get you right where you need to be.
One moment, please.
Oh, it's right here. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Say something positive and keep it short. Oh, that's for me. Jill said there's someone. Okay. I'll move it along. That was really incredible. Thank you. Love you very much. I have not asked anybody to give out the chips. Michael.
Hey, everybody. I'm Mike. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Rusty, that was awesome. Thank you. I've been around through Patty for years, but it's very nice to actually hear your story. And there's a lot of spirituality there, whether you admit it or not. So we have plastic poker chips for real people. If you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, or you've been out on maneuvers, had a drinky poo or two, and want to come back and have pick up a white chip, we offer a white chip. All right. So.
Child, things moved out of my way.